Coming up next on This Week in Law, we've got Mike Godwin, Greg Sergienko, and Jonathan Frieden talking about freedom of speech on the web, encryption and self-incrimination, and all things going on with internet privacy. That's coming up next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is This Week in Law, episode 150, recorded February 24th, 2012. Pretty Cryptic Privacy. This episode of TWiL is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All stream directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. Hello and welcome to This Week in Law. I'm Evan Brown, and I'm hosting the show this week while Denise is off. We've got a great panel of folks that I am very eager to introduce you to, starting with Mike Godwin. Hello, Mike.
Hi.
Mike is really a star on the big stage of law and the internet, and he has been for many years, pretty much for as long as there's been a public internet. He is a champion of online freedoms, having served as the first staff attorney at the Electronic Frontier Foundation back in the 90s, where his work included involvement with the Steve Jackson Games case and Reno versus ACLU, which was really the first big First Amendment case involving the internet. He was general counsel for the Wikimedia Foundation for a number of years and is currently a consulting attorney there. He's also had involvement with Privacy International and the Open Source Initiative. And Mike has, at least in my mind, been best known for writing the important book called Cyber Rights, Defending Free Speech in the Digital Age, which was first published in 1998 and had a revised edition in 2003. Really a seminal, a definitive work when it comes to so many of the important issues that deal with the internet today. And there's much, much more you can learn about Mike by reading his Wikipedia page. So welcome to the show, Mike. Really happy to have you.
It's great to be here. I don't know why I haven't been here earlier. I feel really great to be here.
Oh, well, really, really happy. I don't know why you haven't been here earlier either. We're honored to have you. Gregory Sergienko is a law professor at Western State University College of Law in Fullerton, California. Hi, Greg.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Really glad that you're here. Professor Sergienko teaches civil procedure, torts, and remedies. He's a Harvard grad, has taught at a number of law schools across the country, and has been widely published on a number of topics. And one really intriguing topic that the professor has written about is the interplay between the use of encryption keys and the Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination. That's something that I really look forward to talking about today. So in addition to all the other great topics we have, I'm really looking forward to having a conversation about that issue, particularly in light of some litigation involving that very issue out of Colorado. And there's also a bit of some breaking news today with a federal court of appeals decision that has to do with the Fifth Amendment and encryption. So welcome to the show, Greg.
Great to be here.
Yes. Jonathan Frieden is a veteran of TWiL and is a partner in the D.C. area law firm of Odin, Feldman, and Pittleman. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you, Evan?
Good. Great to have you back. John is a skilled litigator handling a wide variety of matters, including commercial disputes, intellectual property matters, and other technology and e-commerce issues. He also is a blogger. He writes the blog called E-Commerce Law, which is at ecommercelaw.typepad.com, a pretty useful resource when it comes to these issues. And I just saw a press release saying that Google listed John's firm as a go-to law firm for intellectual property law. That's a great distinction. Is that true, John?
It's a great honor. Obviously, the best accolades come from your clients, Evan, as you know from being a private practice lawyer. So we just found out about that late last week. As a matter of fact, we're very excited.
That's great. Congratulations. Welcome to the show. Glad you're back.
Good to be back.
I'd like to start out our conversation here about internet freedoms, and you know, kind of taking it from a general perspective, and then working down into some more specific issues. What really has gotten me thinking this week is a decision that came down actually last week from the European Court of Justice, and it has to do with online filtering. And what the issue in that case was whether a social network over there would have to, at the request of copyright holders, install filtering software to keep pirated content from appearing online. A very fundamental issue where a copyright holder or a content owner was asking for government regulation, a government-imposed regulation on an online service provider here to stop the availability, to limit the availability of copyrighted content. So Mike, I want to start our conversation with you on this. You know, for years, you have helped people understand the importance of open communication on the web. And you know, your writings from the 90s and your advocacy work with EFF and other areas has really dealt in this issue. It dealt with this issue. And one of the things that you have made very clear in your writings and the material you've made available to the public is that there's kind of this persistent battle against certain norms that people have, and early in the 90s, this dealt with people's perception of the internet in general. In your book, you do a great job of talking about the cyber porn scare of 1995. If people remember, back that far, there was this really big scare, this norm. It was like, the internet is this awful place, and it's going to ruin the lives of everyone, because of how it's going to be harmful to the children. So, my question to start this off at a very general level is, what are the biggest threats today in 2012 to online freedoms? What got me thinking about all this was this decision from the European Court, which tackled head-on the question of filtering. How might that fit into the larger picture of what the biggest threats to online freedoms are in 2012?
Well, let me take the European Court of Justice case as a starting point, and then maybe we can sort of expand from that. The difficulty in trying to impose on service providers an obligation to filter for content is really twofold. One part of it is the problem of recognizing infringement mechanically. Can your computer somehow recognize automatically that something is infringing content? And mostly they can't, absent some infrastructure to support that, and maybe a lot of infrastructure to support that if you want to do it at the network level. And the second thing is that the internet is fundamentally designed it could be understood as millions of connected digital copying machines. And so it's very difficult to constrain copying legally when technologically computers and the internet make copying so easy. So that's sort of the copyright set of problems. And the industries, the copyright industries, the publishing industry, the music industry, the movie industry, and so on, have relied historically on the fact that making copies, the mechanics of making copies has been hard. Throughout the Middle Ages, it was so hard that you had to have monasteries filled with monks doing it for lifetimes in order to reproduce works. And now, of course, people can do it at a click of a mouse. So that's the copyright set of problems. And then apart from that, there's the fact that lots of institutionalized interests, both in the private sphere and in the governmental sphere, are very troubled by the degree to which computers and the internet empower people to speak, to disseminate troubling content. It may not be infringing, it may be political, or it may be pornographic. There are all sorts of things that are troubling to people, or it may be privacy invading. And so there's an existing tension between on the one side the way technology has developed, and on the other side a whole lot of institutional expectations and also individual expectations about the way the world should work. And we're still hashing this out. This is a generational thing. We keep seeing new cases and controversies come up relating to internet and technology precisely because it's so revolutionary. And I don't expect the problems or the issues to end in my lifetime, but it's really important for all of us to, and by all of us, I mean all citizens, not just all lawyers, but it's really important for all of us to really begin to internalize our understanding of how the internet works and what our social norms are should be.
Is the nature of the concern about piracy and the concerns of the content industry, is the nature and the character of that concern that we see manifested in things like SOPA and ACTA, that different than the kinds of things that we saw 15 or so years ago when people were scared about other things on the internet? Like, the best example I can think of is porn. Is right. The nature and the character of that concern different these days?
Well, I think they're similar in some ways. I mean, there's an element of, what sociologists call social panic that informs a lot of the discussions of copyright nowadays. And certainly it informed a lot of the discussions of pornography on the internet in the mid-90s. And actually, I wrote about this in Cyber Rights even before the copyright issues really came to a head. Because it was clear, if you looked at how the technology works, that copyright issues were going to come to the fore very soon, and they did. So on the one hand, the copyright industries, the movie companies and the music companies and so on, are quite right to recognize that these technological changes threaten to upend or at least disrupt their existing business models. So they're quite right to worry about that. I think that's appropriate for them to be concerned about it. And the question is, how do they respond? To what extent is it really a social problem? They've responded by trying to push out the costs of enforcement of their rights in copyright to third parties, either the government or to individuals or to network providers. What we found, though, based on independent data gathering, is that the music industry seems to be alive and well, even though it's really, really easy to send unlicensed copies of songs around. The movie industry is doing very well, even though it has increasingly become easy to move unlicensed copies of movies and television shows around. So whether this is a problem that it requires a lot of legislative change is really a number one topic of debate right now.
Greg, what's your perspective on how what Mike was calling social panics? I don't know if what the phenomenon we're talking about here is the same thing as what others call moral panics. It seems to have a greater sense of urgency or something in its import. So assuming that we're talking about the same phenomenon here.
Yes, I meant to be understood that way.
Good. But Greg, what would you think would be a reasonable perspective in a very broad sense here for online governance, regulating content, the transmission of content, given the fact that there is such a bent toward irrationality that's based on interests that people are coming from, whether that be a moral interest, an anti-porn perspective, or a copyright interest, or a pro-privacy interest. I'm wondering if you're willing to talk generally about how to meaningfully regulate the online space, given that propensity toward that reaction.
I think one of the interesting things about this is how it connects different ideas. The rights holders are very concerned about their copyrights and their monetary issues. And their mechanism for doing this that the EU court has rejected is to require the installation of filters on other people's computers. And these filters will necessarily, as I understand it, screen all the things submitted, which inflicts privacy costs on people who use those other systems and burns the people who are supplying the hardware and software, because they have to do a lot of stuff electronically that they wouldn't have had to do otherwise. So you know, coming at it from sort of the lawyering perspective, you wonder about costs and benefits. And if you make this a free install that you're going to require people to do, which is the approach that the European court rejects, the rights holders may get callous about how much harm they're doing to other people. And it's, you know, from my perspective, it can be difficult to get a sense of what's really involved. Rights holders tend to equate the pirating costs with full face value of the things that they're selling. But we don't know that people would be willing to pay that price. So it may be that, you know, a way to avoid panic is to stop court orders requiring people to do things at other people's expense and leave more room for negotiation and pursuit of remedies that are based on actual harm rather than just setting out edicts requiring people to do a lot of things.
John, you represent businesses and you've represented some pretty well-known intermediaries, online intermediaries, service providers. What's the obligation? What's the role of that layer in all of this transaction when it comes to ensuring that not only their rights are well put forward, but also that the way that they're presenting those rights also serves the public interest, if at all possible? What would you say from the commercial standpoint in all of this, from the intermediary layer?
Evan, I think it's important to note that in terms of my clients and also in terms of all of those intermediaries, for the most part, those intermediaries are also content providers or content creators in other contexts. So they have as a motivation a balancing between the interests of the rights holders and then the interests of the consumers on the other end, and then of course the intermediary is sitting in the middle. But I think it's important, and I think that Mike and Greg both mentioned the balancing aspect of this concept, and whether you call it moral panic or social panic or merely alarmism, it's important to note that this isn't new. The internet as a medium of communication may be new, but these concepts have been dealt with for a long time. I knew that we were going to talk about this issue, and I knew that we'd probably spend quite a bit of time on it. And I started looking at what how we'd handled the situation in the past when it arose in situations where there were new medium of communications developed. And I came across a story of a very famous artist in his time who in talking about a very similar issue said that he and others like him were being victims of a serious infringement on our clear moral rights to our own work. And that sounds a lot like what you hear from the recording industry and the movie industry today on these issues. But that was in 1906, and the famous artist was John Philip Sousa. His argument actually was against the recording industry. What he was complaining about was the predecessor of the RIAA and the development of the phonograph, because he felt that what that was doing was stealing the rights of the artist to make money by performing their works live. So I think as citizens and certainly lawmakers, when they look at these issues, have to demand that we have some perspective with respect to the size of the problem. Clearly, piracy is an issue, but the needs of the rights owners have to be balanced against the needs of society, and society has to demand that we get accurate information about how bad the problem really is. If you look at the recording industry, for instance, oftentimes they cite two statistics about the loss in revenue since the development of the internet, and they argue that essentially citing that correlation is causation, they argue that that's due to the fact that people can download sometimes illegally and sometimes without paying songs online. But when you look at the history of the recording industry, you realize that they have part of the issue in terms of their reduced revenue is not based upon the internet at all and not based upon illegal downloads. Back in the early days of the recording industry, back in the 1940s to the 1970s, it was common for an artist to release a single on a 45 record. And I don't know, Evan, you're about my age. I barely remember them. But I do remember having purchased some in high school. So if you were an artist and you wanted to make a lot of money, you had to release a lot of good songs. Now, back in the 80s, the recording industry realized that they could make more money if they sold songs in bulk. So essentially what they would do is they wrapped up one or two good songs into a package called an album with 8 to 12 songs that nobody was really interested in, and they would sell it for $15 to $20 a piece. So if you had a song or two that you liked, you had to buy the entire album because singles were difficult to come by. Now, with iTunes and other sites that provide opportunity to download and purchase essentially what are singles, it's reverted back to the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, where we as consumers get the choice in terms of which songs we're going to purchase. We aren't forced to buy them in bulk. And so as an artist, if you want to make a lot of money, you have to release a lot of good songs, which is probably how it should be. Now, that's just one example, and I'm not suggesting that piracy is not a problem. The issue is that piracy certainly is a problem, but I think some of the things that we're told about how bad a problem it is ignore certain other factors that cause some of the loss of revenue in some of these industries. So I think what has to be done, both on the lawmaker side and certainly on the citizen side, is that we have to balance, we have to demand perspective from our lawmakers. We have to require that any regulation in this area balance not only the needs of the artists in the industry, but also the consumers that are purchasing this content.
I remember I had an Eddie Money track that on a 45, so that was my best experience with that medium. So I mean, one thing that's for sure is that the data seems unreliable in all of this. You know, what the real effect of piracy is on the industry. So that's certainly one thing to keep in mind with all of this. So, Greg, one thing that you said really stuck out with me, talking about how rights holders have the tendency to become callous about what they're doing. And then, John, when you were talking about John Philip Sousa, I started thinking, well, was John Philip Sousa being callous about what he was doing to the detriment of everybody else involved? So I'll turn this to you, Mike. What do you think? I guess one question I could ask you was John Philip Sousa being callous about other people's rights, perhaps in the same way that, if we can be so bold as to generalize about big content, that they're being callous about other people's rights, like in the integrity of the DNS and, you know, otherwise not breaking the internet when they're putting forth interests like SOPA? And if so, how do we deal with those interests in a meaningful way?
Well, I want to say that I don't want to sort of attribute to them, to the rights holders who are arguing for regulation, for new regulation. I don't want to attribute a character flaw to them necessarily. I think quite often the problem is that they have not really understood at a very functional level, but certainly not at a very deep level, how these technologies work. And so their view, and in fact, I think it was the view in Washington when SOPA looked like it was about to pass, the view of rights holders and policymakers is, we know our technology can do anything. So if you are not filtering for copyrighted content, it must be that you're callous to our rights. And so quite often the accusation actually of callousness comes from rights holders who say, here we are toiling in the creative fields and you take our labor and misappropriate it, without our permission. And you're callous to our moral rights as creators and to our economic rights as participants in the information economy. It's a little bit, the argument to me is in some ways analogous to the argument or the quasi-argument that used to be made, if we can put a man on the moon, why can't we cure the common cold? It turns out that that's really, those aren't analogous problems. And similarly, I had a rights holder who's very much anti-Google and anti-internet in some ways because he doesn't, I think, understand quite what the technology requires, say that the fact that the internet is designed, at a fundamental level in a way that facilitates the sharing of files ought not to be relevant to the arguments for rights holders. And in a courtroom, And my feeling, my answer to him was, do you think that, you know, he said, do you think that the design of the internet should trump the rights of copyright holders? And my argument was, do you think the rights of copyright holders should require the redesign of the internet? You know, at some point, I think the people who have adapted best to the way the internet has been disruptive regarding you know, the content industries are the people who have really embraced it. So you find writers who are very proactively distributing their works, sometimes for free, as loss leaders to create markets for their writing. You find the same thing among singer-songwriter creators and even among independent movie makers. And that's a very exciting development. What you've and at the same time, ironically enough, the studios are actually doing great. I mean, the whether it's Avatar or whether it's you know, this upcoming Disney movie of which I'm dying to see about John Carter of Mars. You know, they're doing well. They anticipate great revenues, and if you track independently their revenues over time, what you find is that even though pirated, licensed copies of movies appear online, often very quickly after release, they don't seem to be affecting the box office that much. So I've had a kind of a wandering answer here, but I wonder if I've addressed the question that you asked.
Well, if I ask an open question like that, I'm perfectly content with getting a wandering answer. That's really what we're looking for. I guess my big comment from that is, you know, we can't cure the common cold, because not only can we not put a man on the moon right now, the U.S. couldn't even put a guy in orbit. You know, that observation was made this past week with the 50th anniversary of John Glenn's flight. We have to rely on Russia to do that now, very, very ironically. So just one quick follow-up on what you said there, Mike, and this is taking this into a kind of a more detailed and a different direction here. You said about people who put their works online for free, hoping to expand their market. How legitimate do you really think that is for someone who doesn't already have some sense of popularity and a certain following and a certain community before they make that decision? Because we've heard plenty of, you know, Radiohead doing that and Trent Reznor doing that and, sure, you know, other famous artists doing that. But, you know, I've known about Trent Reznor's work for 20 years when he was certainly the beneficiary of the big machine that is the content industry. Is that really something that's viable for lack of a better term, a startup content creator?
It seems to be the case that if you have the means of production at hand, typically for a writer, it's just any computer, and for a musician, the cost of home production are actually so much lower than they are in the studio environment. There's a band called Pomplamoose, which I recommend to you. Actually, it's a duo, Pomplamoose, I believe is how it's spelled. And their entire market for touring was created by internet releases of typically of cover songs that they produced in their living room. And they actually make a point in their videos of demonstrating exactly how each instrument is used and each technology is used to generate their music. That's one of the things that makes them very exciting to watch on YouTube. They have a channel on YouTube. So I think it's possible, entirely possible, for creative individuals of all sorts, in all media, to really do a very low capitalized distribution of their creative work for free and build a market. I think that's entirely possible. It's enabled, in fact, by the very same cheap digital technology that the traditional content industry see as a kind of threat.
Well, I'm ready to move us on to another point here pretty soon. Wondering, Greg, do you have any response to anything that Mike has said about the content industry and its distribution?
Yeah, it's kind of a funny thing. There's some evidence to suggest that what we like is kind of random, that if you give two groups of people exposure to musics, the different groups will pick out different favorite things. So in a kind of social wealth sense, it's not so clear that we benefit as a society all that much from having really highly popular groups. That if we were a parallel society starting off, we might end up with a different set of groups and would be as happy with that. So, there's a financial aspect to the rights industry, but that might be different from social wealth. And that's an unanswered question to my way of thinking.
So we might not all have liked I Love Lucy back in the 50s had it been more of an open-tail platform back then. Or
what
long-tail.
We like could have been totally random.
Yeah. John, what about you? Anything that you're triggered to say in this discussion?
Just that I think that the ease of distribution, the ease of creation of content benefits consumers, which ultimately it benefits the most people. I think that the content, the big content, as you described it, Evan, is concerned about making money under the traditional ways that they've always made money. And what they need to do is to adapt to the new technology in order to profit under the new paradigm. And those companies that can adapt have been profitable and will continue to be profitable. And those companies that can't, won't.
Great, great. Well, I'd like to talk next about encryption and the Fifth Amendment, but I'll invite those of you watching and my co-panelists here today to sit back for a moment and relax while I give props to our sponsor, Netflix. This episode of TWiL is brought to you by Netflix. Netflix streams thousands of TV episodes and movies directly to you instantly, which means you save time, money, and hassle. There are several easy ways to instantly access streaming movies and TV shows with Netflix. You can watch Netflix movies and TV shows on your Mac or PC or iPad. You can watch on your iPhone and some Android phones too. If you have a gaming console, an Xbox 360, PS3, or Nintendo Wii, you can watch Netflix right on your TV. And if you're not a gamer, you can watch Netflix on your TV with an Apple TV box or a Roku box, which is my favorite way. They're inexpensive and easy to use. With Netflix, you can watch movies and TV shows instantly using any of these devices, and you can begin watching a movie or show on one device and then finish it on a different one. Whichever ways you choose to access Netflix, you can watch as many movies and TV shows as you want anytime you want, and you can cancel at any time. Try Netflix today for 30 days free. Go to netflix.com/twit. Be sure to use this URL when you sign up for your free trial. That's netflix.com/twit. We thank Netflix for their support of TWiL, and we hope you enjoy watching instantly with Netflix. So let's shift gears and talk about encryption and the Fifth Amendment. Now, this is really an interesting situation that's going on in this space right now, because it's one of those questions that's been kicking around at a theoretical level for many years. In fact, Greg, you've written a law review article. You wrote a law review article about this way back in 1996. The question of what are the contours of the interface between our Fifth Amendment right to be free from incriminating ourselves versus our abilities to store information in an encrypted fashion. There was a case that came out of the district court in Colorado called Fricasoe, and I know there are different ways of pronouncing that. But long story short, the defendant in that case, she had her hard drive encrypted using PGP, and she was arrested for mortgage fraud, and the cops came pursuant to a warrant and grabbed her hard drive, and they had some evidence based on a recorded phone conversation, a jailhouse phone call, to suggest that there were incriminating documents on that hard drive. And the defendant, she asked the court to actually, in response to an order or to a motion seeking the court to make her turn over the encrypted copy or an unencrypted copy of that hard drive, the defendant argued that that would violate her Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination, and the court rejected that argument and held that I think actually today is the deadline for her to turn over to the feds an unencrypted copy of her hard drive. That is, if she can actually remember the password, if she ever knew it. And just today there was, or actually it came out yesterday, just heard about this. It was a Court of Appeals decision down in the 11th Circuit, which is in Atlanta. This was a child porn case, and the guy actually had not been arrested yet, but the feds had gotten some external hard drives. I think there were 5 external hard drives, and they were encrypted with TrueCrypt. And the judge in this case, in the action that the guy was pursuing, well, actually what happened is when the guy wouldn't turn over unencrypted copies of the hard drives, he was held in contempt of court. And so he appealed, saying, hey, I shouldn't be held in contempt of court. I shouldn't be in jail over this. And the court held that it would violate his Fifth Amendment privilege, his Fifth Amendment right to not have to incriminate himself if he turned over unencrypted copies of these hard drives that the feds had had gotten pursuant to a search. So Greg, I'd like to talk with you about this. You know, you've given a lot of thought to this issue of encryption and the interplay, the interface between the Fifth Amendment right, the privilege against that. And I'm wondering if you would comment. You know, what are the big issues? How should we be thinking about these rights that we have in the face of technologies that allow us to encrypt our data, and that technology is available to essentially anyone? What's the framework? How should we think about these things?
One way I like to think about this one is kind of from a historical framework. When the Constitution was drafted, we had in the initial Bill of Rights a Fifth Amendment protecting you against self-incrimination, and a Fourth Amendment that protected against unreasonable searches and seizures. And the way that Fourth Amendment was interpreted for a long time was to allow the government to seize things that you'd used to commit a crime or that you'd gotten from the crime, but the government couldn't seize mere evidence. Now, that was changed about 50 or 60 years ago. So the government could seize evidence. And before that time, your diary would not be subject to the government's power to search or seize. And there were cases saying this. So in a sense, what powerful encryption techniques are giving us is what the Supreme Court has taken away with its decisions limiting the privacy and search and seizure rights that were understood at the time of the framing of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. With respect to how the details of this case get reasoned through, the idea is that the Fifth Amendment protects you against incriminating yourself. And it protects you against incriminating yourself only in a special way called testimonial self-incrimination. So I can be forced to give my fingerprints. That is not testifying. But I can be protected from a court order requiring me to confess a crime. And more recently, the Supreme Court has held that I can be protected from being forced to produce a combination. And digital keys are like combinations on safe deposit boxes. Because the Supreme Court has said those things can't be compelled from people, the latest strategy from the government doesn't ask for the cryptographic key or a passphrase. It asks for the production of the unencrypted version of the encrypted hard drive. And now in this Colorado case and in the 11th Circuit case, we see conflicting approaches, with one case saying, sure, go ahead, and the other case saying, no, we don't. And coming at it as I do from a historical perspective, I think there's a strong argument for saying the 11th Circuit's the one that's got it right. We are, under the government's approach, going to have much, much more narrow privacy rights than we would have had at the time of the framing. And the fraud case in Colorado is kind of an especially hard case, in my view, from forcing the compulsory production of the unencrypted drive, because to the extent that this person has committed fraud, we can get good evidence of all the fraudulent statements this person made, because those statements had to be made to other people. So the government wants the icing on the cake of its prosecution, but it's not clear to me that it really needs that to have its case. And requiring the person to produce this seems to me to go around the United States Supreme Court decision in the Hubble case, which shielded things like the combination.
Greg, I think one of the things, and you can tell me if you disagree, I think one of the things that we see operating in this bank fraud case is the government knowing or believing that they have a clearly guilty defendant, and they, apart from just wanting the slam dunk of having an unencrypted hard drive that they can inspect, they also want to slant, the decision-making process in the courts as much as possible in the government's direction. And there's no better way to do that than to pursue an argument, a procedure argument, or a fundamental rights argument like this one against what they believe is a clearly guilty defendant.
I'm not inside on the government strategy, but they've got clear guilt there. The other case they're pursuing, though, is a child porn case. And in terms of whom society dislikes most, I think even as between bank fraud perpetrators would probably say the child pornographers, especially if they're dealing in things that involved real videos, are worse. So, in that sense, I don't know what the government strategy is. So the 11th Circuit case seems to go first because it's now on appeal, and it may in that sense have been a stronger case, although it's harder for the government in that case to prove that there really is a crime going on. And that's something that the 11th Circuit focused on. It said, the government says there's lots of stuff here, but the government wasn't able to prove that there really was anything on all these hard drives. And because of that, they weren't able to succeed in their claim to get this unencrypted version produced.
That seems like a really important point to me. The difference between these cases, and it makes me even wonder if maybe both of the courts got it right in their respective contexts with all of this stuff. Because in the 11th Circuit case, just reading from a report about the case, not reading from the case itself, but it was saying that all the government could do was show that the storage space on the drives could hold files that number in the millions, not that they actually do. It couldn't find any files that were actually there. They didn't know about it, which is unlike this Vermont case from a few years ago where the Border Patrol agents had actually seen child porn on this guy's computer and then weren't able to find it later because it was encrypted. And then in the Colorado case, we have this jailhouse phone call that was recorded, which provided independent indication or independent evidence that there actually was information on there. So, I mean, am I correct or am I mistaken in seeing that really is a very important factual distinction between these decisions that actually could reconcile them, even though they came to contradictory holdings? I just to turn that over to either one of you.
I think that's a good thought. I mean, we'll see where it goes because there's different strands of reasoning that may come out. First off, you're really correct in how you summarized the Atlanta case, which came out of Florida. TrueVault, which was the encryption mechanism in that case, produced garbage random characters for non-encrypted files. So there wasn't blank space on the disks. There was stuff on all the disks, and that made it impossible for the government to say what there was. But even though there was the jailhouse testimony about the desire to get this stuff away and a suggestion that there was encryption on it, the 11th Circuit followed some old cases saying, you can compel the production of the documents if their contents are a foregone conclusion. And the conversation in the Colorado case was vague enough so that I don't think that it met the foregone conclusion test.
Yeah.
I think one of the things, by the way, I recommend that people read Greg's writings on this topic because I think he deals with these issues quite comprehensively through Hubble. One of the things that I think you see is a tension that really has arisen from the court's earlier efforts to try to define certain kinds of conduct as testimonial or not testimonial. So, for example, you generally can be compelled to produce evidence if it does not itself seem to be or qualify as testimony from you. There's been a narrow exception carved out for that, where if you produce the evidence, that in itself has some kind of testimonial value, showing your ownership or control of the tools of a crime or the profits from a crime. And what you see is efforts by law enforcement agencies to grant immunity that's very narrowly defined, so that sometimes it's called the production privilege. So that if your production of the evidence is itself testimonial, that cannot be used against you, and that is typically considered a right answer by law enforcement. But the problem with compelling people to disclose stuff that's in their minds feels, I think, to many people fundamentally different. And to me, the most helpful analogy, and I wrote about this, I guess, 15, 16 years ago, but to me, there's a case, a Supreme Court case called Rochin versus California, where the defendant swallowed a couple of capsules of morphine that he was possessing illegally, and the sheriff or the law enforcement agents took him to the hospital, and they compelled vomiting up of the morphine. And the Supreme Court said, "Look, you know, whatever this is, we can't have people doing that. We can't have compelled vomiting up of evidence." And there's a sense in which compelling people to disclose something that's in their minds feels a lot like roaching and not a lot like producing the key to a lockbox.
Jonathan Frieden, people are freaked out about this issue. You know, I mean, it's crazy to think that the government could force us to turn over this stuff. You know, we have this 11th Circuit ruling, which, you know, at least so far has protected a guy who's accused of trading child pornography. I mean, I'm wondering if you're willing, John, to talk to people's concern about this, that's making them freaked out about all this. Is this issue, the fact that we have this decision from Colorado, which forced this woman to turn over an encrypted hard drive, and then we have these other, this other decision from the 11th Circuit, is this an issue that really merits the level of freaking out that's going on? And if so, what would you say to those people who are?
Evan, I don't think it warrants a significant amount of freaking out. If you think about it, in listening to the conversation about the independent evidence issue with respect to the difference between these two or three cases, I go back to what I was taught by Professor Baskell, who used to be one of Professor Sergienko's colleagues, where I went to law school at the University of Richmond. In terms of the independent evidence issue, that issue really comes into play under a Fourth Amendment analysis, a unreasonable search and seizure analysis, and it gets into whether you have reasonable suspicion or probable cause to make a search. It really doesn't get into, it doesn't affect the Fifth Amendment analysis, based on my recollection, because, for instance, someone being compelled to testify at trial in a way that would incriminate themselves, it doesn't matter how much other evidence you have against them. You can't force them to get on the stand and admit that they committed the crime. It simply doesn't matter. So in the context of these two or three cases, the analysis, to the extent that it's based on external evidence, in my view, is flawed. But what you're looking at here is in the one case where the information was compelled to be produced is not a testimonial or not a compelling of testimonial of testimony that incriminates the accused. It's being forced to provide evidence which preexisted the government action. So it's not testimonial, and it doesn't come in under the Fifth Amendment. It's not protected under the Fifth Amendment. It may be protected under the Fourth, and those rights and those privileges and those protections may have, as Professor Sergenico pointed out, may have eroded over time, but the fact is that it's the Fourth Amendment that protects that issue. With respect to the concept, and I think that the 11th Circuit stated that one of the bases for their decision was the fact that the mere fact, as Mike was talking about, as Mr. Godwin was talking about, of producing the information would act as testimony in some way, you know, demonstrating that the accused had control over the information or the content, and that the accused had taken some action to protect it from disclosure to others. And in that instance, it seems to me that the court correctly made that decision because certainly those the fact of having the password that would unencrypt this information does act as proof that you had control over it and that you were hiding it, essentially. But it seems to me that it's fairly easy to get around that, either through a production immunity offered by the prosecution, or if a court simply does not admit the evidence for the purposes of demonstrating either control or an attempt to hide. Under the Fifth Amendment, a violation of the Fifth Amendment protection against self-incrimination only occurs in this context when the incriminatory statement or conduct is introduced in a criminal case. Now, whether that means a criminal trial or pretrial action is unclear depending on which circuit you're in. But the fact is that if this information was admitted only for the purpose of this was on this computer owned by this person, and the prosecution did not seek to admit it for the purposes of the fact that he could produce it in unencrypted form, the fact that he had control over it, and the fact that he had been trying to hide it, it seems to me that no violation would have occurred. And in terms of freaking out, you know, there's a balancing, once again, of the freaking out. Obviously, people want to keep their information private and protected, and that's a legitimate interest. But as a father, I think I have a legitimate interest in not having child pornographers running around. And given that most child pornography now is distributed and stored in electronic means, my fear is what does that do to child pornography prosecutions if you permit the mere encryption of this content to protect it from the prying eyes of law enforcement? And now you mentioned that TrueCrypt, and the TrueCrypt is the program that was used in the 11th Circuit case. TrueCrypt is not just available to nearly everyone with a computer. It's available to everyone with a computer. It's absolutely free, and it provides protection that even the government can't break within a reasonable period of time. So you know, if it was going to take 5, 6, 10 years to break the encryption of this content, then you run into the accused speedy trial rights. So you're never going to be able to prosecute a person for having child pornography as long as that person stores the pornographic images on a computer and uses TrueCrypt to encrypt them. If you can't require them to produce an unencrypted version of their computer, with, of course, the protections that the mere fact that they provide it would not be used against them in court.
Jonathan, you know, I think Jonathan's absolutely right to underscore that, you know, individually and collectively, you know, we have a strong interest in law enforcement being effective. I think that's absolutely true and unquestionable. At the same time, in any world in which we circumscribe what law enforcement can do with regard to individuals, we make law enforcement inefficient. And I think it was Orson Welles who said that only is in a police state is the job of a policeman an easy one. And I think we have to accommodate in a democratic society where we have lots of acknowledgement, not merely of individual rights, but even of minority points of view, and you know, individual rights as they stand against the rights of society as a whole. You know, in any society that honors individual rights, as we try to do, we're going to have to accept a certain amount of inefficiency on the part not only of law enforcement, but also of our national security interests as well. And it's hard. I don't want to pretend. I don't want to seem glib about this. These balancing acts are very hard. My feeling, like Greg, I read all the cases regarding compelled production of documents to, you know, Boyd and Fisher through the Doe cases and so on, all the way to, you know, to the present day. I think the efforts that the courts and law enforcement have made to try to compartmentalize the production of quasi testimonial or testimonial evidence have actually left individuals less protected. And as a civil libertarian, I'm troubled by that because I think, in addition to having a social interest to apprehending and punishing child pornographers and to destroying that market, we also have a collective interest in preserving individual rights. So that's how I harmonize it in my mind. And once again, I think we face a balancing act, just as we do in the copyright context.
Greg, what does this say about our about the current state of our privacy when issues like this are being litigated, sometimes to what appear that they could be contradictory results? What is I'm wondering if you would talk about how this does play into the roles of whether or not we're protected from criminal activity or whether our privacy is more protected. Could you speak to that?
I think what's interesting about this for me is that we've started defining these things as rights of privacy, and actually we've done that now for a while. When the Constitution was framed, we thought about them more as issues of property rights. You know, you had property rights in certain things, and the government couldn't take those rights away by grabbing what you had. And when we start talking about this as a privacy thing, we're removing the protection from some body of law where it's going to be tied to commercial interests and putting it to a spot where it's only going to affect criminal cases. And when it gets to criminal cases, we start looking at this as balancing and we start talking about efficient law enforcement. And the trend here, which may have been an inevitable one, is that the privacy rights get stripped down. So although I'm not ordinarily a fan of Justice Thomas, I think he's got some interesting ideas in his Hubble concurrence and talking about looking at the historical framework. And I find that pretty helpful in this context too.
Well, let's continue talking about privacy, but in a different context, but same in as much as it has to do with, you know, this thing called the internet that we love so much. I don't know if you guys saw this past week that the Obama administration issued a 50-page report that it's marketing as the Consumer Privacy Bill of Rights. Did anybody take a look at that? And I know this wasn't in the official list of things that we were to look at for today, but anybody take a look at that and have any comments on that? Or, absent any particular comments on that, if you have any comments on what the position of the executive branch should be when it comes to online privacy. Mike, what do you have to say?
Well, I think that the focus of the online Bill of Rights, and I haven't studied it carefully, but the focus of the Bill of Rights that came out of the Obama administration regarding consumer privacy has been on what commercial interests, what private interests typically do with your private information in terms of gathering it or reusing it or identifying you or targeting you or profiling you. The difficulty here is that, if you look at various online services from Netflix, which looks at which movies you've rented with your consent, by the way, you agree to that as part of your end user licensing agreement and part of your subscription agreement to Netflix, or with Google and, Gmail and the ability to target ads based on the content of your Gmail. What you see is that many people just choose to waive their privacy rights. So in some sense, even if you have a framework that guarantees a baseline of privacy protections in the commercial context, or even non-commercial, but in service provider context, it doesn't matter necessarily because people routinely click through waivers where they basically waive their privacy rights. And then they discover at some endpoint, to their horror, that they have in effect allowed some end user, some corporation to profile them. What is interesting to me from the executive branch point of view is that the executive branch is inconsistent on this. When it comes to governmental interest, as I think we've seen in the criminal cases we just discussed, the government is much less interested in privacy as an inherent value. So the government, and this has historically been true. It's not unique to the Obama administration or to any particular administration in recent decades. You know, when it comes to its own interests, the government's much less concerned about individual privacy. When it comes to commercial interests, certainly you have, apart from what comes out of the Obama administration directly, you have the Federal Trade Commission has historically been concerned with privacy, and from time to time, legislators take up the issue. One of the things that's interesting about Clarence Thomas's concurrence in the Hubble case, which is the criminal case that Greg was just referring to, is that, of course, Clarence Thomas and his video rental records were targeted in the course of his confirmation. And Justice Thomas, I think, remembers that very acutely. And one of the results of it was a journalist who was trying to get access to Justice Thomas, then nominee Thomas's Clarence Thomas's video rental records, was one of the outcomes was an amendment to federal law that forbade video rental stores from disclosing those lists. Well, entertainingly enough, video rental stores themselves are kind of on the ropes. so it, in some ways, it's kind of a weird little annotation
Still kind of relevant in some of the Facebook beacon litigation, remember, because there was information about what the videos. But in any event, go on. Yeah.
In any case, I'm always interested when Justice Thomas speaks out on what could be understood as an individual rights issue, especially with regard to things like privacy. Greg recommended Thomas's concurrence in Hubble. I think that's worthwhile reading. People should read Hubble generally. Once again, as I said, it would really be nice if you had an executive branch that consistently devoted itself to protecting privacy, both in the criminal context and in the commercial context. But I don't really see that happening anytime soon. And the Obama administration's inconsistency on this issue is not unusual.
John, I'm wondering if you see any irony in the fact that we've got the Obama administration ostensibly saying stuff where it's in favor of consumer protection, whether or not it's being disingenuous or not, it's saying that. Do you find any irony with that? And also, pushes from the same administration, as well as the Attorney General in the Bush administration, saying that there ought to be a law that requires internet service providers to retain information about folks' web browsing history for longer periods of time, something that on its face sounds less in the interest of an individual's right to privacy. I'm wondering if you see the same irony that I do, and if you've got anything, any annotation to make on any such observation of irony on that. You might be muted, John.
So you would think that I would be able to use this technology better, but I guess not. you know, somebody trying to be ironic. That's right. It's censorship, government censorship. I'm not surprised by it because, as Mike pointed out, this has been the government has always spoken out both sides of its mouth with respect to these sorts of issues. In the consumer context against big corporations, the government has said that consumers, you know, deserve to have a right of privacy. They deserve, to have, certain liberties associated with their interaction with these large companies. But that's not the same thing that the government says when they interact with the government. The Patriot Act and things like that, obviously, are contrary to the concept set forth in the White House's 52-page document on a consumer bill of rights or a bill of rights with respect to internet privacy. But what I think it underscores, aside from the difference between how the government treats interactions between the citizens and the government and between the citizens and corporations and other citizens, is what it underscores is that we're in desperate need of an omnibus federal privacy statute. Many countries in Europe have them. Many states have enacted them. Something like a third or maybe nearly a half of states have enacted enacted privacy legislation with respect to transactions online. But I think it's time for the federal government to get around to actually passing one. I know a couple have come up through Congress. I think the Obama administration has put out this 52-page document, which essentially rehashes a lot of the same themes that have been common to that legislation. Those bills that didn't pass, and also, quite frankly, is common to what the FTC is currently doing with respect to privacy enforcement and privacy protection. I think ultimately what it comes down to is the FTC has for years said that consumer privacy for people that transact undertake transactions online comes down to a couple things. One, the consumer has to be given notice as to – it's fair for the consumer to get notice of what information is being kept about them and how that information is being used. The consumer should have control over how that information is distributed and when and to whom. There should be security associated with the information so that it's not disclosed in a way that the information is not disclosed in a way that the consumer did not authorize. And I think that's common to all of these, all the bills that have been through Congress that have failed. It's a theme, and I haven't gone through the entire Bill of Rights, but it's 52 pages long. I'll get through it probably this weekend. But it's a theme that emerges from this as well. The fact is that I think we all agree that is fair. And then the issue is then how do we go about doing it? And the fact is that what the Obama administration seems to be suggesting is the government itself should be taking care of that issue. That's one of those situations where I think it was Ronald Reagan that said that the scariest words that you can possibly hear is, "I'm from the government, I'm here to help you." My view on that is that the power to enforce privacy rights should be handed to the citizens, that we should leverage private enforcement mechanisms, create an omnibus federal privacy act that essentially acts as a private attorney general statute that enables private citizens to bring actions against corporations who violate their internet privacy. And a statute like that would provide for attorney's fees and would provide for statutory and perhaps treble damages in cases of willful misconduct so that you could enable a private citizen who might not otherwise have the means to bring a federal lawsuit against, Yahoo, for instance, to do so, and also incentivize attorneys to bring those causes of action. And as you all know, the private attorney general concept was very effective in enforcing the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and its later amendments. And it could be very effective in this area as well. And most importantly, for this time in our history, it would be fairly budget neutral to the federal government. So rather than placing the burden on an underfunded and overburdened federal agency to protect our rights, why not hand us the power to do that ourselves?
Greg, somebody listening to what John just said could come to the conclusion that he's suggesting a European approach to privacy regulation. And John, I'm certainly not trying to put words in your mouth. You may disagree with that. But for purposes of this question to you, Greg, is the idea of omnibus federal privacy legislation, even if it grants, you know, an individual party the right to bring a lawsuit, a civil cause of action, you know, this private attorney general concept. Is that the best way to handle the issue of consumer privacy, or are there better alternatives out there, or should it be in conjunction with other things like industry self-regulation, which sounds like kind of there's a quasi mix of that going on with California and its attorney general striking up agreements with Google and HP and Apple and Amazon and others? Or does the answer lie in consumer education, notwithstanding the fact that, as Mike observed, nobody reads these privacy policies anyway. Nobody really, you know, cares about their privacy. Is the top-down approach the best way, or what's the right approach at a general level on this?
Well, there are definitely some advantages to legislation. First off, federal legislation avoids a problem that we would otherwise have with 50 different states setting their own rules. And it's possible to approach this at the state level, but doing it at the state level makes it very easy for companies to structure their arrangements so they're not susceptible to regulation by states that are protective. So I see a strong point for federal action there. I mean, and at the same time, this approach, and I haven't read the statute. I've read some of the background. As Mike points out, it may not work if it's going to make privacy rights dependable on individual decisions not to waive. I mean, we've faced this situation in the law a lot. People agree to waivers of rights because they don't have very much choice and because they don't pay much attention to them. So the old-time contract approach to protecting people's rights to a good automobile didn't work because the motor vehicle manufacturers had a standard form contract that basically gave you nothing. And we had to take, as a country, a totally different approach to that. We made it not turn on individual agreements because that turned out not to work out from the perspective of most people. So not having read this federal decision, but thinking about some of the things we associate with European approaches, less focus on individual agreement. There may be something to the idea that we just want as a society to set standards and not give individuals so much ability to opt out of them. Now, there is one difference between privacy rights and things like automobiles. No consumer gain from getting a defective automobile. And what those people who use information will say is, we can benefit you when we get your personal information. We benefit you because we can provide you with search results that are better tailored for what you want. We can give you advertising in stuff that you're interested in. And yes, that's a benefit to advertisers, but it's a benefit to you, the consumer, too. So I don't think we've had enough of a discussion in society on, you know, how much sense it makes to waive things, how much these abandonments of privacy by individuals are benefiting those individuals who waive them, and the social costs that we may incur by having individuals waive rights, even though those are in individuals' selfish short-term interests.
Mike, give us a 30-second synopsis of the Roman numeral one level issue that's on your mind as a last word on privacy right now.
Well, I think Greg has really hit the nail on the head when he talks about individual waiver. I mean, you know, I am on the advisory board of Privacy International, and I pay a lot of attention to privacy advocates who point out, what the privacy risks are. There's really a couple of dimensions to it that I think people ought to keep in mind. One is that, in fact, a company like Google can very credibly argue that their ability to gather some information, maybe they anonymize it, and I think Google takes some pains to anonymize, although maybe not enough, but they do take pains to anonymize data. But still, they collect data which, in order to optimize their search results. And one of the reasons I think Google has the market dominance that it has in search is that they're really very strongly attuned to calibrating search results based on the data that they gather from users. At the same time, one of the things that people need to keep in mind, you've been mentioning the European approach, Evan. One of the things that people need to keep in mind is that if a private entity gathers data on you for commercial purposes, it becomes at least theoretically possible for government or even for private parties who are taking legal action against you to require the production of that profile on you, of all the evidence that, of all the information that's been collected about you. And in Europe, for example, there's a much stronger, there's generally a much stronger emphasis on the value of individual privacy. At the same time, the data retention requirements imposed on telecom and internet companies are much broader and much more comprehensive than here in the United States. So these are problems that all industrialized societies are really tackling right now. Possibly not the People's Republic of China, but most, certainly the countries in Europe and in North America are tackling these issues. And there's a recognition, I think, that if you gather a lot of information about what individuals do, and if you collect it, even if you do it for the best of all possible motives, it can ultimately be turned against the people that you are trying to serve.
And on great, those are great observations. So let's bring this into the home stretch. I know that some of us on the call have lunch meetings to get to. Those of you who watch Twill on a regular basis know that we usually feature a resource of the week and a tip of the week. Our resource of the week is, mentioned it earlier at the top of the show, Cyber Rights. It's a book, Cyber Rights, Defending Free Speech in the Digital Age by Mike Godwin, one of our guests today. I just can't stress enough, how important this work is. It's, an early perspective on the big issues facing the law on the internet, how we should think about all these issues that arise that we spend so much time on the show thinking about, the First Amendment, privacy, intellectual property. I really recommend this book to you. The most recent edition was in 2003, but it's certainly as timely now as it was when that second edition came out. I just downloaded my copy on my Amazon Kindle.
That's right. I wanted to emphasize that it's available on Kindle. I bought a copy for myself on Kindle because it's searchable. So I can find out what I said.
Right. Yeah. So I'm Mike, I'm not just saying it because you're on the show, but I'm saying it earnestly to everybody watching here. It's canonical in its space, for the kind of texts that are here. So everybody should go out and buy a copy of this book, either hard copy or electronically. Our tip of the week comes from a piece in the Atlantic Wire. I think this was just out yesterday, but a guy in New York. Well, I guess he was in New York City, and this has to do with New York City. It was a guy who made a comment on a post on The Gothamist. And the New York Police Department arrested 49-year-old Richard Strauss. I don't think he was a classical composer. It might be his nephew or something. For threatening New York Police Commissioner Ray Kelly in the comments. Some really great comments here. He said, a well-placed round of ammo to his thick skull would work quite well to eliminate the threat that he poses. It goes on a little bit more. And later in the post, in a rather derogatory way, he challenges the police commissioner, saying, come on, Kelly, get me if you have the appropriate anatomy to do that. So tip of the week is, don't make threats of physical violence against the police commissioner. Them's fighting words. They may not be protected by the First Amendment. So be careful when you're making challenges like that online. So, well, let's go around the room and say some final words here. Let's start with you, Mike. Thank you so much for being on the show. Tell people where what your preferred means of people knowing what you're up to online is. I know that you're on Twitter. Tell us where to go.
Well, you can certainly reach me on Twitter or Facebook. Those are probably the easiest ways to look me up. My email address is mnemonic, mnemonic at gmail.com. So if you want to contact me directly through email, you can do that. I can't promise to respond to everyone who does, but I do read all my email.
Right on. And you are SF Mnemonic on Twitter. That's SFM.
Yeah, San Francisco Mnemonic, SF Mnemonic.
That's great. Well, it really has been an honor to have you on the show. Really enjoyed our conversation. Thanks so much, and I hope we can talk again soon.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah. Greg Sergienko, thank you very much for being on the show. Wonderful time.
It's been great to be here. I really enjoyed hearing from the panelists.
Yes, yes. And you are you're not on Twitter. Any preferred way of people getting a hold of you, knowing what you're up to, or you want to lay low?
Laying low is good, but people can keep up with me on LinkedIn, and they can write me at my work address, which is just my first initial G and last name, Sergienko, at wsulaw.edu.
Right on. Well, thanks again. Really have enjoyed our conversation, and hope we can do it again soon.
That'd be great.
Jonathan Frieden, always good to talk with you, my friend.
Evan, great to talk to you too.
Yes, where are you online?
People can reach me through Twitter. It's at Jonathan Frieden, JonathanFrieden. And if they want to reach me by email, it's jonathan.frieden at ofplaw.com.
That's right. All right. Well, then, thanks. Thanks, guys. Thanks for your great comments. And that is a wrap for episode 150 of This Week in Law. Talk to you next week.